Good evening.
Good evening.
And welcome. I'd just like to start off by saying how grateful we are to all those who have contributed to the Ronning Center's Distinguished Visiting Speakers Endowment, which makes such evenings possible. My name is Paul Harland, and I'm a professor of English here at the Augustana campus. And it is my great pleasure to introduce you tonight to Tim Lilburn. Let me tell you a little bit about him and his work. Born and raised in Saskatchewan, Tim joined the Jesuits and moved around Ontario and the United States to pursue his education and fulfill his vocation. He left the order in the 1980s and worked on farms around Kitchener. When he returned to Saskatchewan, he took a job teaching philosophy at St. Peter's College in Munster. A Governor General Award winner, he currently teaches at the University of Victoria. Tim is the author of the essay collections Going Home and Living in the World as If It Were Home, and 8 books of poetry, including Orphic Politics, Kilsyte, and To the River. A number of his books are available in the Augustana Bookstore, so please make use of the Augustana Bookstore. Tim's poetry and essays ironically have a close connection to silence. Having grown up in a taciturn family, he once explained, "We were denizens of Western Canada, where literature had not yet appeared. Speech was a simple tool meant to get the potatoes passed." Despite the fact that he has since turned into a wordsmith, many of his poems reflect the spare, empty quality of prairie space. It is a place that teaches patience, or perhaps what Margaret Avison calls fierce listening. Here's what Tim has to say about poetry and poetic attention. "Poems are praise songs or a careful, lonely moan for the world. Either way, it is the world itself that lifts them forward. They are the speechlessness of things ripening, pressing into language. The poet contributes attention, permeability, a courageous leisure in which transfixity may occur. The poet combs out the lines until they come as close to shining as he can bring them. Yet another sort of silence can be a room you inhabit, a room of waiting, a room which is a sort of ear. Writing is this availability, listening's stripped place, in which the hidden lives of things, pumpkins, poplar groves, might be transcribed. Writing is mostly this craning quiet." In a recent issue of The Walrus, Mark Dickinson described Tim as one of the chief proponents of an ecological renaissance underway in Canada. As both poet and essayist, Tim is helping us to rethink how Canadians relate to the land in which they live. Sensing that most people, especially those living in cities, have a tenuous relationship to the land, and that many experience a profound displacement from where they live, Tim attempts to see how this relationship might be changed, partly by drawing on Aboriginal knowledge and partly by paying more attention to the neglected contemplative side of the Western spiritual tradition. Contrary to the dominant view of viewing nature instrumentally, Tim attempts to evoke an attitude of humility in the face of the particularities of nature. He helps us to see how fierce listening, based on respect, can foster a new relationship that may allow us, more fittingly, to call this land home. So please join me in welcoming Tim Lilburn.
Well, it's great to be here. It's great to be back on the prairies. I've lived in Victoria for the last 5 years. I'm still getting used to living in Victoria. BC's just a little too beautiful.
You know,
like, Yeah, like chocolate cake is great, but if you eat a whole one, you'll get sick. So, yeah, it's taken me a while to. I was saying to David coming in from the airport, it seems to me learning a landscape is like learning a new language. And as you get older, it gets harder to learn new languages. And so after 5 years in Victoria, I would say I'm sort of, kind of, a little bit moving in. A bit. And it's also an extraordinary pleasure for me to be here under the auspices of the Ronning Center. This is an amazing thing that you have here. No one else has really anything like this. All kinds of colleges and universities have named lecture series, but no other place in Western Canada that I'm aware of has this level of dialogue and exchange and outreach into the community as you folks have here in Camrose and Edmonton. So I commend you on this, and David as a director, this is a jewel that you have. Now, I'm not just saying this to butter you up. I mean, I have a reason for saying this, and this kind of ties into the talk that I'm going to give tonight. About 20 years ago, a man that I respected told me that I should read the Canadian philosopher George Grant. Some of you know of George Grant. Well, I was just this Northwest Regina fool, and I kind of nodded and said, "No, it's okay, I'll start reading George Grant." Anyway, George Grant changed my life, especially the essay In Defense of North America, where Grant says that folks like me, that is, descendants of European settlers, they may know, they may sense that there are gods here in the mountains, in the boreal forest, in the rivers and whatnot, but they also know with a kind of sick certainty that those gods will never be theirs. Never be theirs. Why? Why? Because of what we are, said George Grant, and what we have done. And Grant claimed that we, and by we I mean descendants of European settlers, had lost track of the European contemplative tradition. Had just completely lost track, and Grant was a Baroque skeptic, like skepticism 2 or 3 kilometers thick, and he said that there was no way that we could retrieve this. There was no way that we could resuscitate our connection with the European wisdom tradition. Anyway. This was 20 years ago, and I'm not a Presbyterian, I'm a Thomist, and I thought, there's got to be a way back. There's got to be a way back. One of the books that Paul mentioned a minute ago, Going Home, is an account of my personal attempt to resuscitate this tradition, at least for me, through a particular form of reading. Anyway. As a result of this encounter with George Grant, I have spent the last 20 or so years reading Plato, who George Grant said was a good idea to read. I mean, I'd gone to university, and I'd even taken part of an undergraduate degree in philosophy, so I had a kind of a bumbling acquaintance with Plato. But anyway, 20 years and a graduate degree later, I have come to believe certain things that Plato said. One of the things that Plato said was that the root, the only root of the sole authentic politics is the contemplative life. There is no other root for an authentic politics. There are other forms of politics, but these are sophistical forms of politics. These are confections. This is casuistry. This is not real politics. And you see this in the allegory of the cave and throughout the dialogues, rises out of contemplative attention and a devoted contemplative life. How do you build a contemplative life? Well, people write books about this, but I think that there are many elements. But let me give three things give a contemplative life, and around these three things, the enterprise of contemplation orbits. One is spiritual conversation. By spiritual conversation, I mean between two people who are interested, phenomenological accounts of their personal spiritual experience. Contemplation will lift out of that. So spiritual conversation. Deep thinking. You know, beyond the newspaper, beyond even the revered CBC. Deep thinking. And thirdly, thinking inside dialogical or dialectical exchange. All of us think better when we think in the context of conversation. And all of you have experienced this. You have the mind of one interlocutor, the mind of another interlocutor, and if the conversation is rich, there's a third mind, the mind of the conversation. So authentic politics grows out of these three activities, other activities, and I'll talk a little bit, if I actually get into my talk, I'll talk a little bit about these other activities in the talk. But these three I see right at the top. And in just having Googled and the Ronning Center and looked at print materials, this is what the Ronning Center does. It fosters spiritual conversation, it fosters deep thinking, and it fosters thinking within the context of dialectical exchange. So you folks may be sitting at the center of the origin of the one of the few true political socks in this country. You could say he speaks hyperbolically. Well, perhaps he does. He's a poet. Why wouldn't he speak hyperbolically? But follow the reasoning. And believe me that this sort of thing is not going on elsewhere. It's not going on where I teach, the University of Victoria. It's not going on at UBC. Green College makes a brave step, but it's no. This kind of widely ecumenical, broadly curious. Hopefully, a dialogical thing. No. So it's good. It's good. But you guys are very good, and I'm envious. But anyway, I'm glad to be here and to talk to you tonight. I want to talk about landscape. I mean, partly because I've gone through this struggle of losing a landscape, the prairie landscape. I was beginning of the boreal forest, sand hills kind of guy. My poetic mind, or my most recent poetic mind, came to me when I was living in a sand hill region just southwest of Saskatoon called the Moosewood Sand Hills. I know you folks have a beautiful sand hill area around Dilberry Lake, just a little not too far from here. And the South Saskatchewan River, I moved from that to Victoria. So picking up a new landscape, very, very hard to do, very hard to do. In fact, if I would have known before I left Saskatchewan that it was going to be as hard as it turned out to be, I may have rethought that move. So I want to talk to you about landscape and our feeling for landscape and around landscape, and then I want to talk to you, and these things are actually connected, but it'll feel like I'm making a bit of a jump. I want to talk to you about Christianity and contact with Aboriginal people and the history of that, this sort of long kind of mythopoeic war that has been going on in North America for 400 or so years, and Christianity's involvement in it, and where it could possibly go from here. But first of all, I would like you to do some work on your own. I hope it'll be pleasurable work. I would like you to take a minute and imagine, just call to mind a place that is beloved for you. It could be a grove of aspens. It could be the North Saskatchewan River, or the Peace, or the Red Deer, or the South Sask, seen from a boat or seen from a shore. It could be a chair in your apartment or your parents' house back home. And you really like that chair because it's a comfy chair, but you like the way light falls across it in the afternoon. Or it could be a stretch of highway that you remember seeing from the cab of your father's truck. So just take a place. Could be a neighborhood. Just take a place. Find a place and call that to mind. There was a Christian, I assume everyone's found this place, eh? So just kind of hold on to it and I'll talk around this. There was a Christian philosopher, very early Christian philosopher, whose name was Origen. I don't know if you've ever heard of Origen. Extraordinary man. He wrote, I think, 2,000 books, something like this. He wrote so much he had to have people take dictation, and he just wrote book after book. He was a famous exegete. His exegesis of scripture was extraordinary, and he was an Alexandrian. But he was also a Neoplatonist, and he was a philosopher. And Origen had this idea, this extraordinary idea, that everyone has a body inside their body, or to put this a little less bizarrely, everyone has a set of senses inside of themselves that is like, so the ear of the heart, a kind of interior mouth by which we savor and taste things, a kind of interior hearing. So as you were thinking about this place, your sweet place, I'm prepared to bet that you were savoring it with this interior person, with this interior set of senses. You were tasting it. You were tasting its deliciousness. Or you were smelling it. Victoria smells different than the prairies do. Just to smell the grass and the dust. And yeah, it's just a different kind. So, but and just the inner person was savoring this. And we'll kind of come back to this inner person. In a sense, you could say contemplation is living inside this interior body. That's what contemplation is. Tasting and savoring things that, well, anything really. Holding them. So our sweet place, our favorite place, our good place, the place that we go to often in mind and go to as often as we can in body. It's great to go there. It's pleasurable. These places calm us, and they seem to assure us and lighten our lives. We feel lighter, kind of floating sort of comes into our light. But I will bet you, I'm a person who likes to make bets. I will bet you that we don't often talk about these places. And if I ask you to talk about these places now, you'd probably be embarrassed. And you'd think, this is the speaker putting me on the spot kind of thing. I think we don't talk about these places because they seem both too private and too inconsequential to mention. Too private, too inconsequential. They seem both crucial, this is strange, crucial. I can't live without that place. Crucial and unimportant. Now, one reason that such private intuitions that we've been enjoying for the last minute or so about sweet places, one reason that such private intuitions or intuitions like this are seen to have almost no social value and make pretty well no appearance in public discourse is that they're not really linguified. They don't really come into language. They seem to precede language and elude language. Now, all of us know that we can yank these sort of private, protected, nourishing goods. We can yank them into speech. We can do that. And we do that if someone demands a kind of accounting of our allegiances or insists that we tell them exactly where we stand, or if we want to protect those that poplar grove from the bulldozers. We have to yank this stuff up. But is that a good thing to do? Is that like almost as soon as we do that, the significance of these places just it shrinks. Almost as soon as we bring these things into language, the beauty of these places, the complexity of these places, our emotional connections with these places, they just undergo this, all those things just undergo this kind of dramatic reductive pressure, just kind of pushes down on these things. Then there's the matter of how we typically do speak of land. We talk of land as a resource, as real estate, possession, investment. Now, if you if you set those imaginings that you've got in your mind of your sweet place behind these ways that we normally value land, then that kind of thinking around sweet place starts to look sloppy, sentimental, unadult, non-objective. So this is another reason why we kind of keep it out of language, because we don't want to be looked at that way. We want to be seen as hardcore modern people and who have their eye on the bottom line, so on and so forth, and are trying to extract the resource from the soil. So what are we going to do? What are we going to do? We have these sort of private loves, these things that these relationships with land that kind of identify us, tell us who we are, and that nourish us, but we can't speak about them, because if we do speak about them, we could either lose dignity pretty quickly, or we could cause the beauty and the power of these things to simply evaporate. Like, language can do that to certain things. Everyone thinks if you put language on something, it gets bigger. Sometimes if you put language on things, it just, like, someone's nodding, yeah, it just goes away. The old monks had this practice, and the old monks had a lot of good ideas, I've discovered in the years of reading them. This practice is called disciplini arcani, the discipline of secrecy. Disciplini arcani. And most people are smart enough, heads up enough around land love stuff, to just not talk about it, to just hold it like a nation's gold preserves, you know, like just kind of keep it down there. But then that means that it doesn't appear in language at all. So do you see the impasse we're in here? Like, there's true value in these recollections, in these places, but we undergo huge risks. Most of us don't want to undergo these risks because it's just not worth it. We either lose dignity and are excluded from the conversation, or the thing simply. So what are we going to do? Some people think poets are going to bail them out. Here's something finally useful for poets to do. They can give us a language to talk about land love. But look, I'm a poet, and I in the gentlest possible way, I need to tell you that this is a romantic illusion. that poets, if they value their craft at all, are just as much at sea around talk about land as anybody else. It just doesn't work anymore to sort of bare the breast, bare the romantic breast, and wax poetic. It's just no. The box that we're in is getting narrower and narrower. Do you see her difficulty? Like, we can't. Here's something very important. We just can't talk about it, and it can't have any kind of political currency because you need language, right? So. All of us are quiet on this matter. There's a way. And the way is this. A phenomenological description of an encounter presented to a worthy conversational partner. If you've undergone something traumatic, grief or illness, or you've fallen dramatically and violently in love, you will walk miles to talk to someone who has undergone exactly the same thing. You believe it completely. That conversation. And that conversation will vivify you. It will fill you up. So on this matter, there is a way out. There is a way out of silence. Talking to people who have undergone the same experience as you, talking to people who have been snake bit, as Alcibiades says of his conversations with Socrates. I was snake bit by philosophy. I was snake bit by this man. So, like, all of you actually have been snake bit because you have called to mind this sweet place, your sweet place. Right? So, I can take a risk here, and I can talk to you about my sweet place without thinking that it is going to evaporate or I am going to topple into foolishness. What follows is a kind of map of delight and identity. I ask you to picture a low mountain that stands alone on a coastal plain. The sea, the Pacific Ocean in the form of Harrow and Juan de Fuca Straits, is visible on three sides. It is 3:30 on a summer afternoon, and the heat and the light are beginning to corrupt. But the day is still hot. This mountain possesses two climatic worlds. The east side is wetter, more temperate, forest of Douglas fir. You go a little bit further, higher on the mountain, you get into large leaf maple, snowberry thickets. We have snowberries on the prairies, but in BC the snowberries are like softballs kind of thing. And then you come to a cliff face, and on that cliff face are the succulents in yellow bloom. Emily Carr, most of you have heard of Emily Carr. She loved this place that I'm telling you about. She used to, she had this, what would you call it? Kind of like a trailer, but it was sort of like a hay wagon that had plywood sides on it. She called it the elephant. She'd get someone with a tractor in rural Saanich to haul her out to Douglas Park. She'd live in this trailer, and she had a menagerie that she'd bring with her: a couple of dogs, a rat, a monkey. Maybe she had other things, but at least the rat and the monkey were there. So she'd come out there to this area that I'm talking about when she wanted to think hard and paint. And she says in her journal, hundreds and thousands, she says she would come out because she wanted to know what the trees were going to say to her. You see how close you're skating to the edge of, like, sounding, whoa. But anyway, that's what she would do. The west side of the mountain is considerably drier, sun more scouring, a slope of isolated oaks, parched meadows of long white grass. I park the truck and begin to walk. Today I have chosen the eastern slope because of the steepness of the ascent
and the way light falls through a canopy with green coolness. Then there's the matter of smell. At this point in the year, Oregon grape, quite thick on the slope from midway up the mountain, sends out a comfortable, nearly indescribable odor, something like a mixture of wet wool, decaying wood, and algae water. This blends with the sap of the fir. I walk for a few minutes along a well-worn trail, then turn right and start to climb the southeastern edge of what is called in the Victoria area Mount Douglas. I've recently learned that the mountain has another name, quite an interesting name. It's called Pakuls in Senchosen. Senchosen. This is the first, it's a Coast Salish language, and it's the original language of the southern end of Vancouver Island. Senchosen is one of these sad but beautiful languages. It is slowly dying. The man who told me that Mount Douglas is called Pakuls is a young poet, Philip Kevin Paul, whose new book, Little Hunger, is nominated for the Governor General's this year. Kevin, when he told me this story, was one of 25 speakers of Senchosen. But there have been deaths through the summer and early winter, and I think we're under 20 speakers of Senchosen. This name, Pakuls, very interesting. The word means white pointed top. White pointed top. What do you think that name says about the mountain and settlement patterns of Coast Salish people? White pointed top. What could that be, white pointed top?
Snow.
Snow. Yes, definitely snow, but it is the peak, but what's making it be white? It's the snow, but it's also a glacier. A glacier. So when that mountain received its name, there was still a glacier on Pakuls, the top of Pakuls. There hasn't, because they can work this out through, I don't know, archaeologists, and I don't know who would do this, but anyway, they can work out that the ice in that area vanished 10,000 years ago. So this means, just that word, the fact that that word exists, means that Coast Salish people, Senchosen speakers, were there. The old theory of Clovis First says, no, they came 8,000 years ago. But the language says, no, 10,000, maybe older than that. Anyway, I walk up Pakuls. I walk through Oregon grape beds and beneath the call of their sumptuous smell. The track I am on zigzags up. I stop often to catch my breath in the leaf-flickered light. This place, so it seems to me, sometimes hears me, looks at me, and names me. And I am so grateful that I have found it. When I left Saskatchewan in my early 50s, a few years ago, I thought I'd never find a good spot again. In other words, I thought that I would never find another spot that would take me in. And it ended up I had to put in five and ongoing. I mean, I'm still doing this, putting in a kind of apprenticeship to that land, a kind of novitiate to that land, learning the names for things and so. But I mean, I didn't know that this is what I was doing. I was just trying to keep my head above water. I had no job to go back to in Saskatchewan. I gotta, like Merton says, if you do not learn the genius of the place may throw you out. And I believe this. I believe this. I couldn't afford financially and otherwise not to. But T.S. Eliot says that a poet throughout his life or her life has a single voice. A single voice. If you're lucky, you may get a second voice. I changed my compositional methods radically at the end of the 80s, so I had my second voice. I thought I wasn't going to be able to speak in this place, this new place. And I also thought, I also felt that the chances were strong that I wouldn't actually be able to breathe, like deeply, existentially breathe in this new place. So let me tell you, without no exaggeration here at all, no poetic riff or anything, I was scared, like deeply existentially scared. I thought, but then slowly stuff opened, like, and kind of took me in. I'm not saying this in a kind of boastful way. I'm saying that I am about, in relation to that land, I'm about 3.5 or 4, maybe, just tottering. But something's opened. And I hope by speaking it, I haven't, caused the door to close a little bit. I hope I've spoken about it with respect in a way that it will like. Okay. So, what's happening when we talk about place in this way? What is happening? Well, or we see a place deeply. It could look like we're wasting time. And it's quite true. That's exactly what we're doing. We are wasting time. This is significant wasting time, essential wasting time, but we are wasting time. I have another question, a philosophical question. What is the epistemological, like what is the standing in knowledge of these acts of attention and absorption? What is the epistemological significance of my walk up Douglas? What is the epistemological or the cognitive or noetic or philosophical significance of you remembering that beautiful spot that is precious to you? Some people would think this is a very funny question. They would think it has no epistemological standing whatsoever. It's just it's philosophically useless. But it is my claim that that the memory exercise that you did a minute ago and the story that I told you just now, that this is understanding of a remarkable sort. When we hold these places in mind, or we enjoy these places when we are in them, I believe the kind of mental savoring that goes on when we are doing that, that this is prayer. This is prayer. Specifically, it is contemplative prayer. Not liturgical, vocal prayer. No, contemplative prayer. It is a form of prayer that the Christian philosopher, a student of Origen, Evagrius Ponticus, called Theoria Physicae, natural contemplation. The true knowledge of existing things. Evagrius, like Origen and his other teacher, Clement of Alexandria, as well as being a Christian, was a Neoplatonist and a Pythagorean. And as a result, he was convinced that the natural world held in a kind of way the unutterability of divinity, of God. That the natural world, God is still unknowable and beyond for a Neoplatonist, certainly for an apophatic theologian like Evagrius, but there is a kind of revelation, there is a kind of epiphany of divinity in nature. He wrote in his book Practicos, the kingdom of heaven is apatheia, that is freedom from possessive desire, along with knowledge of existing things. These two things fit together, the lessening of attachment, the desire to manage, consume, and real comprehension. And in this fit, as we hold these things in mind, as we hold these special places in mind, we are living in a new world. We're living in a new world. And we have a new kind of ontological citizenship, a new kind of citizenship in the world. Everything has changed. It's brighter and it's calmer. Okay, this gets worse, actually. Or better, whatever, however you're measuring it.
As we remember these things, we are in a state of prayer and enjoying the hospitality and pleasure of prayer. No one should be able to knock you off that puck. You should be able to hold that as long as you want. But I think something else is happening, and here's where the plane of this talk actually takes off. I haven't been on a jet for a while. Those things almost go straight up in the air. It's extraordinary lift. So here's the lift here. We started out by thinking that remembering these beautiful places, these sweet places, that some of us feel that our lives are based on these places. That's where our sanity lives. Like I sometimes think, Douglas knows how to work through this better than I do. I'm going to go to the mountain and it's going to kind of let me in on how things are going to play out here. So we have gone from thinking that that it is useless and has no standing whatsoever, and justifiably makes no appearance whatsoever in public discourse, and has no political shadow. We've gone from that to conceding that it may be a form of prayer, maybe a form of contemplative prayer, and because it is, it's good. Okay, here's the other thing I'm going to tell you. Please. You've been very patient up to this point. I ask for even more patience. Hold on to your hats. When we are doing this, when we're thinking about these places, we have not just been praying, we have been understanding the truth. Not a truth about the world, but the one truth about the world. You know this story that John Duns Scotus was killed by his students? They rushed him at the front of the room and they stabbed him with their pens. I always have this fear at this moment in my presentation that, oh, here they come. I've got a battle plan where I was going to flip up the table. Anyway, no, it's just my paranoia, my hobby. But this wasn't the worst. This wasn't the worst. We've only started. We've only started. A lot of our tradition we've just simply forgotten. It's just covered with sand and asphalt and stuff like that. We just simply have forgotten it. And all kinds of extraordinarily valuable insights, especially around this matter of contemplation. In Platonism, in Christianity, Neoplatonism, it's just, I spent 25 years going into libraries taking out books that were last taken out of the library in 1958. You know, like I'm going to torture you now with this one fruit of my reading. And I'm going to introduce to you, I'm going to put before you a person that the European tradition has simply forgotten. We knew about him for a while. He still lives in Islam, but we have simply forgotten him. His name is Surawardi. 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 Surawardi? Yeah. He was a 12th century Persian, Neoplatonist, and Sufi practitioner, and the founder of the Ishraq, or Illuminationist, a school of philosophy within Islam. So if you don't mind, I'm going to make a digression here to talk a little bit about Surawardi. But this is, I'm doing this to show what I mean by saying when we remember these sweet places, this is very high. This kind of a mental work has a very high epistemological sound. We are understanding the truth. But I can't just claim something odd like that. I have to show what I mean. So we're going into Surawardi. So are you ready? A little bit of philosophy? Yeah? Okay. Surawardi studied philosophy in a series of centers of learning in Iran. Then he wandered in Asia Minor and Syria. He was looking for spiritual masters. He finally settled in the city of Aleppo in northern Syria. And rather quickly and rather dramatically met his death. He irritated a number of local jurists with his views, which he expressed with verve and charisma, and they talked Saladin into convincing his son Malik, who was the regent, newly appointed regent of Aleppo, to kill Suruwardi, which he did by starving him. Anyway, and he died in his mid-30s. But he did a tremendous amount of philosophical work before he did die, and I'm going to explain now the philosophical work he did. So this is where the philosophy gets a little bit hardcore, but I think everyone's up to it. And it's like hockey. You don't think of philosophy as hockey. I mean, I always do. anyway, I'm in a hockey pool, and my pool name is Allegory O'Cave. Everybody says, nobody in your pool, except for the people you work with, know what your name means. Well, other people's names, fish ass, big girl's blouse, but Allegory O'Cave. Yeah. Okay, so what Suruwardi wanted to do is he wanted to draw Islam away from what he saw to be the radical rationalism of an earlier philosopher by the name of Avicenna, who was an Aristotelian. And Avicenna is about a century before Suruwardi. And he wanted to replace radical hegemonic rationalism at the center of Islam. He wanted to take that out a little bit. He's not an irrationalist, but he wanted to take it away from the center. And he wanted to take some of its power away. And he wanted to put in its place mystical experience. He's not an obscurantist. He didn't want to abolish rationalism. Rationalism has certain important functions, like how am I going to pay my taxes if I'm not a rationalist? But he wanted to push it aside, take away some of its power, and insert mystical experience there. In fact, for Suruwardi, intense interiority was philosophy. The full comprehension of the world. And in this belief that intense interiority was philosophy and the full comprehension of the world, he resembles the Christian Evagrius, who said, if you are a theologian, you truly pray. If you truly pray, you are a theologian. Intense interiority gives you the world. Okay, the hardcore philosophy continues. The Aristotelians believed that if you could define or capture the essence of a thing, then you had its nature. So if I could define for you the essence of the Aspen Poplar, or the essence of Highway 22 south of Longview, or the essence of Pukulse, or if I could give you the form, if I could give you the essential nature, the form of a chair, a human, a horse, a river, a highway, you could deduce specific individual characteristics from it, and you would have the thing nailed. Suruwardi said, no. All definition of general essence gives you is the way human beings break up and organize the world. All general essence gives you is an account of human subjectivity trying to impose its taxonomy and its categories on the world. It doesn't give you anything about the world. The only way you can know the world is through a direct intuition of individuals. A direct intuition of individual things. What does he mean by direct intuition? Commentators have called this an epistemology of presence, a form of understanding which is a kind of interior tasting of a thing. You know a thing by contemplating it. You know a thing by taking it into the interior sensorium and tasting it. That's what knowledge, true knowledge is. You can talk about Aristotelian categorizations and taxonomy and stuff like that, but that's nothing. That's nothing, since Suruwardi. It's this interior tasting. So what we were doing when we thought we were skylarking and wasting time is we were understanding the truth. The only truth. That direct intuition, that savoring, that interior tasting of individuals. And we know that in our lives. We don't fall in love with woman or man. We fall in love with that Helen Marzoff. That's my partner's name. Like that person. That. You don't know and love essence. You know and love individuals, and you love them in a kind of incoherent, irrational, contemplative way. Yeah. Okay. And this knowing, this is my way of talking about this kind of knowing, it feels like a sinking into an object. Or it feels like, it is a falling in love. So it's a sinking in, it's a being absorbed into the object, it's a falling in love with the object. And then, this is very strange, this kind of alchemical thing is really, really strange. When we do that, what happens to us? We become individuated. You know that word individuation? Jung talked about that, like becoming the person that you are that's unlike any other person. Individuation. When we fall in love that way with a person or with a piece of land or whatever, we become that we get identity. We become individuated. So, how is a place formational? How is land formational? It can be formational for us in that it can make us who we best are, who we are at some full stretch of articulation. The minerals in the soil make our bodies. The shape of its hills, the way wind moves through oak or poplar leaves can sculpt language. Anytime I hear the sibilance of spoken Cree, I hear the wind moving through short grass prairie. Kevin Paul has told me that there is a particular sound in Sinchosen, and I can testify that I haven't heard this sound in Greek, Latin, Mandarin, this particular sound in Sinchosen, it's a guttural, glottal sound. I'm not going to try to make it, I just sound like an idiot. But Kevin has told me that this imitates how water sounds when the tide is coming in and something else is, some other water movement, which I didn't get at all, is pushing out. And that sound exists in Sinchosen and exists because they were a shore-dwelling people. Seeing deeply a particular place individuates. By taking you in, it shows you an angle of who you are. It locates you, makes you cohere, in part by seeming to look at you. You know this place, so this makes for the flavor of person you are. There is in savored land a befriending. The place is a bigger version of you. It is you, it is with or beside you. It chambers a person in herself or himself. I do not wish to speak with sentimentality here. I refuse the charge that I am speaking sentimentally. But I wish to record what seems to me to be an emotional fact of experience, a phenomenological fact. And of course, to lose a place or to lose a certain connection with a place can provoke acute sorrow, a kind of grieving for which we have no name in English. There is a pandemic depression in North America. You've felt it, you've seen it, maybe you're laboring in the depths, and it is around this thing that we don't have an English word for, but it has to do with loss of place. Okay. How are we doing for time? Oh, I'm done. Any questions?
Good. Well, I'm really done.
Time for the highlight reel. How's my pool doing? Yeah. Okay, I'll talk very quickly on this other matter. I think that what I have been talking about, this trying to enjoy and feel and trust land love, is a very important psychological task. It is a very important ethical task, and it is, of all of them, I think the most important political task that we face. Do the soldiers stay or leave Afghanistan? This is significant. But this other thing, enacting our love, huge. And look at how ill-prepared we are. We don't even have language to talk about this. And we don't even really have a safe way to talk about it, if we could find language. Another thing that I think is very important for us here, and I'm going to speak too quickly about this, sort of foolishly quickly, so I'll just be hitting kind of the high points, is I have a strong sense, and this is connected to our, to the possibility of people like me becoming autochthonous, people like me proving George Grant to be wrong and actually learning to be from this place. This other thing I think we have to do as we begin a new century is I think we have to try to rethread the act of contact between European settlers and the original dwellers in North America. You know the word rethreading? If you ever tried to put a bolt on a nut and you don't thread it right, well, you got to back off on it and try to rethread it. So saying we need to back off on this and try to rethread it. And this is, this land love thing is a very hard task. The other thing I'm telling you about, it's a huge political task and also extraordinarily difficult, possibly impossible. I think that we have to admit after, what, contact 1640s or so, Hudson Bay area in Western Canada, that it in many ways, in perhaps all ways, has not been a happy beginning. The use of armies from the east to suppress local political structures, the hanging of Riel, the outlawing of ceremonies like the potlatch and the sweat lodge and the fast on reservations, residential schools, where the poet and Indian affairs official Duncan Campbell Scott proposed the Indian would be taken from the child. You know, Scott was in charge of setting up all these schools. He was a poet. This is what he said he would do. This is what the schools would do, take the Indian from the child. And the loss of Aboriginal languages and cultures, which the schools intended and achieved. The colonization of Western Canada, as I suggested before, was a mythopoeic war. Yeah, people shot at Riel, and Riel shot at, well, Riel didn't, Gabriel Dumont shot at other people. It was a shooting war, but it was more importantly a mythopoeic war. Where one cosmology, Aristotelian, capitalist, and a Christian, subjugated and aimed to extirpate another by an inventively broad range of means, armies, a police force, a punitive, non-dialogic, xenophobic, Eurocentric religion, trade, and the engineering of landscapes by which Aboriginal communities were displaced or poisoned by dams and tailing ponds. I spent a lot of time in libraries over the last 20 years, and not just reading Neoplatonists. I spent a lot of time reading the first European accounts of contact in the Jesuit relations. And, you know, it right from the beginning, there was war. There was, not saying the Jesuits were firing at them, but there was, we have to overcome this culture. We have to overcome it. And these are our means. I speak as an ex-Jesuit with great reverence for the order, no? So, to rethread this, how? How to do this? Two things, I think. One is to enact with Aboriginal peoples, especially during this period of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission around residential schools, enact as best we can a kind of grieving with. I fantasize a kind of nationalism of contrition. But other things that don't feel like we're doing a heck of a lot, and it's going on both sides. It's going on the European settler side, and it's going on the First Nations side.
I attended an extended performance and an informal ceremony over the summer in Victoria, conducted by an artist by the name of Peter Morin at Open Space Gallery. Morin is from the Tahltan Nation in northwestern British Columbia. Some of his relatives are former students at residential schools. Over a period of 6 weeks at various venues throughout the city, but chiefly at Open Space, he enacted 12 pieces of what he called First Nations data. One of the events that I witnessed consisted in this. Morin put into the center of a circle a number of objects, paintings made from chewed birch bark, beadwork, moccasins, and what made this circumference of that circle was were piles of human hair. Now, these objects like these were routinely sent by grandmothers and mothers to grandchildren and their kids in residential schools to help deal with the loneliness and guilt of having sent them there and the kids' loneliness. And the school officials would again routinely confiscate them. And in a dream, Morin saw these things packed in boxes, stuffed with human hair, the hair that school officials would shear off the kids when they came in. And so what Morin was doing was he was trying to heal these objects. It was like the objects were wounded and acting with great ceremony. He said that the purpose of this these exercises was to honor all mothers and grandmothers. I saw these performances as a kind of emptying out of darkness. You know, there can be a situation where there are tears to be shed, but we haven't yet found the person who's going to do the crying. So this he was doing it. It was sometimes awkward, and then some. It was sort of lightly attended, but I saw this as very significant political work and very significant psychagogic work. You know, transformational interior work. The other thing that I think needs to happen, and I will conclude with this, is I've had this fantasy. I have a very good Cree friend, the poet Louise App, and a few years ago, very generously, she invited me to her reservation, Saddle Lake Reservation, not that far from here. And I met her elder, Joe Cardinal, and a wonderful man, died a few years ago, a great man. And I started to have this fantasy, because I'd been hanging around religious communities and been kind of active in the Catholic left and was interested in contemplation. But what if a meeting like this could take place, where elders could meet with folks from the European settler side, and we could break open our bundles, and one side could say, this is what's precious, this is what we've discovered. And the other side could say, this is what's precious for us. But then I thought, before we do that, what we have to do is we have to retrieve our beautiful bundles. We have to retrieve what is rich and gorgeous and deep and nourishing in our tradition. We have to recover the forgotten and the suppressed wisdom lineage in the European intellectual tradition. We have to do two things in order to do this. We have to do scholarship, in some cases translation. And secondly, it's not just scholarship. With contemplation, you don't just know, you enact. We have to give our lives over to these activities. One of them we did tonight. We remembered this beautiful place, a beautiful place for us. And we kind of said to ourselves, at least I hope all of you said to yourself, that that place is precious, and that place has given me my identity. That place has given me, that place is the basis of my life in a way. You know, it sort of supports me. So yes, we have to bring this up. And I think when we do, we will have maybe a new human dwelling on the land. If you savor something, this is another thing about contemplation. If you savor something, if you love something, it is very impossible. It's impossible to do violence to that thing while you're in a state of love.
yes, if you're crazy or something, maybe, maybe, maybe. But really, beauty disarms. Beauty disarms. So there's our ethics right there. There's our land ethics. There's our environmental ethics. And it's, we come to it very simply. We just remember what's important to us. Well, thank you for being so patient with me and listening to this philosophy and other forms of outrage.
Are you willing to
engage
a little bit?
Sure. Oh, yeah. Quite happy to do that. I may have gone over.
Oh, that's okay. Time is a ribbon. I mean, I've been struck for years by what I've called the unexpressed grief of this part of the world. Mm-hmm. In all of the people that have settled here. Because none of them have cared for their ancestors' graves.
Yeah.
So that kind of condition has often struck me as being part of what has framed the relationship with the people of this place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that that's completely true. And my mother was born in rural Saskatchewan in 1919. And all of you know that the 20s were a pretty sweet time. Like, they just seemed to party all the time. And I know exactly why they were happy. They were poor in Europe. And there was no way of getting out of that class system and no way of getting out of that being landless. And like that, in a year, 2 years, farming northeast of Creel and Saskatchewan, that was all past. So who wouldn't be elated? And there was a time, and then the 30s came, but there was a time, I think, like very early on, at least in my family, where I felt, just looking back, doing a kind of archaeology, that there was a possibility that folks would actually sniff something out and leave. But then the Depression, the terrible Depression, year of no crop, 37, the war, etc. And then the 50s, mechanization of farming, that just kind of... But I had an uncle who had extraordinary good luck. He broke his leg in training the day before the Dieppe raid, and he was in the South Saskatchewan Regiment. They had pretty good. But anyway, this uncle was uncanny. Like this one time he took my mother out onto the land, and there was their mother had died. That was the big family crisis, and so they went to the land. He took my mother out onto the land instinctively for healing. And she said, "Well, how will we live out here, Jack?" And he said, "Oh, don't worry. We'll eat crow's eggs, stuff like that." And my mother couldn't stomach it. She came back in, but he stayed out there for days. And I mean that. Even now, as I tell that story, the hair stands up at the back of my neck. Like that was a really interesting contemplative start. Really interesting. But things happen, you know. Farming went to the blazes, and it stopped raining, and the war broke out, and all that. And then the 60s, 70s hit. But yeah, no, I agree with you that there is a lot of. And that's a huge political thing. Like, how do you lift that up? Like, I don't think politics is economics, or I think it's healing. It's sort of, like the politics starts in interiority. There's no, people say contemplation one thing, politics another. No, they're together. Anyway, yeah, there was any other? Yeah.
There are two things come to mind.
Yeah.
C.S. Lewis's Narnia, where everything had a spirit.
Ah.
Spirit of the trees.
Yeah.
Spirit in each of the animals. Do you think that C.S. Lewis was aware of this kind of,
you know,
this dimension, if you wish, of reality?
We've by we, I mean people in the European tradition have been thinking about this for a long time, like Neoplatonism, Pythagoreanism, etc. As long as we've been thinking about what could be in there. I think that the cosmology, the sort of emanationist Neoplatonic Plotinian cosmology that sees, like, you have the one here and it packets of energy is sent out until there is no energy whatsoever, you accept pure matter. That would invest things with a kind of light, and you get to, into Gnosticism, you know, the light one. My feeling on this is I am an apophaticist. Like, I think that one should approach talk about the divinity with great caution. I don't think reason or language is quite up to that topic. I'm not an obscuratus. I don't say we don't talk about it. I could talk for days about it. In fact, I could say that's the only thing I talk about. But approach with great, great, great caution, which is fear and reverence and just an availability to a beauty beyond our understanding. So I would be... I think what is important when approaching things that you have worked out are numinous because you've fallen in love with them. The thing that is important is not the cosmology, but it is the courtesy and the humility and the deference. You don't know what's there, but something is there. Something big. And that big thing somehow is looking at you. I mean, I am a believer, but I'm on the apophatic side of belief. Yeah, I say the Nicene Creed, so I do have a cataphatic bone in my body. There's more than one, I guess, but you have to. You can't be just pure negative theology. But you know what negative theology is. That's not like going against theology. That's like saying divinity is so much greater that it can't be named. We can praise and praise and praise and praise. And all of that praise is right, but it never exhausts. Then it's always more, always more, always more. And so an apophatic theologian is quite conscious of the more. And so manner becomes very important. And you see this also in, if I may speak boldly here, you see this also in Chrysostom, where it's decorum and respect. Not systematic theology. You don't hear a lot of systematic theology going down in the lodge, but you hear a lot about decorum, respect, courtesy. What in the European tradition we would call gravitas, our dignity, but shown by a kind of humble and deferential demeanor toward the humans. So yes, spirit, but you know. Yeah, spirit, definitely spirit. And maybe lots more.
Yes?
You were talking about being absorbed by nature, and earlier in the matter you were talking about like trying to absorb nature into yourself, like consume it. And that seems like not only like a contradiction, but it seems like nature doesn't need you to consume it.
Oh, I know. This is the two-sided thing, you know, you are deferential, you defer, you give it space, you recognize and you may bow to the beauty, but do you kill and eat the critter? Can you do that with dignity? Can your decorum stretch to that? Well, some people have thought about that for thousands of years. You know, people who lived here, the Buffalo. I think you can. Like I'm not saying let's give up everything. It's a manner. You still have an economy. If you act out of courtesy, it just has a different flavor, different slash.
I appreciate your comments about the need for hard work to make a connection with the land, to learn, to understand relationships, to sort out the significance of landscape. But not only are we being separated, we also just don't have time. We're transient in this place. We're moving around, and to find a way out of that to a deeper and greater connection to local places, and it seems like it's almost an impossible task these days. What path do you see?
Well, it's true. I mean, it's true. We are in an anarchic situation. This exactly as Marx said, this is the nature of capitalism. It just uproots. All that is solid melts into air. So just fast. And it is difficult to learn a new landscape. But the task also is extraordinarily simple. You just turn and say, there it is. Or you look out your window and you see the mountain ash with snow on it, and there it is. That's it. You're there. You're right at the center of the couple of life. Like, how you value that, how you think about that, that's a slightly different. But that's no more onerous than just looking. So it's both difficult and very hard. And how? Because we're always moving. I think, for me, this has always been my experience. If you feel your need, if you feel your wound, and you don't try to fill it with other things, and if you wait, if you are, in a way, allow yourself to be pathetic in your need, something may come. Simone Weil had this idea. She had a lot of interesting ideas, but she had this idea that poverty and loss acted in interiority in the same way as a vacuum acted in physics. It just drew substance to it. I'm not that confident. But I think what the scripture says, poverty of spirit. What could it possibly mean that the meek own the earth, except this? The wounded are in need of the ministration of the world, and it comes forward. But you have to live in your poverty, I think. In my case, I just was so blessedly sick and grieved that there was no way out of it. This loss of land and.
Isn't it, Tim, also a discipline? As the more, yeah. The older I get,
yeah.
The more it becomes a necessary discipline.
Yeah. Yeah.
To look at the mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that when I walk to work or when,
yeah.
I have to be intentional about it.
Yeah.
And it's that intention,
yeah.
That somehow,
yeah.
Allows not to consume, but like to be with.
Yeah. And I think that asceticism, and this is, we are talking form of asceticism here. And you know, like, we become really afraid and repelled by that word, but that's right at the center of our tradition. Ascesis, it just means training. It's a word that comes from athletics. You just train. You get exercise your body. Everyone knows you have to exercise your body, or you have to exercise the other stuff too. So yeah, a kind of ascesis or asceticism. And in the first place, asceticism is not self-denial, but it's self-possession.
I mean, the place what is.
But that
even with what is.
Exactly.
It's
like
great.
The place where I work would light me up in that office all the time. Yeah. But no. Or you know, you can just turn away. Well, yeah, well, okay, I'm marking your exam, but I'm gonna look at this. You know, like self-possession, saying exactly what you said here, intention. Controlling the nature of the gaze. Or controlling the engine of intentionality in your life. It's yours. All kinds of people are going to tell you that it's not yours, but if you really thought about it, it is yours. No one else can control intention. You can get pushed around, but that's not control of intention. So yeah, I think in a sense, contemplation, light of contemplation is a kind of criminal life. It's a transgressive life. It's a life that says, "Non seriam, I will not serve. Not I will not serve ever. I'll still teach the class, but right now, non seriam. I'm looking at the non-match. And in my private code of valuation, that's one. Or maybe silent prayer or Lectio Divina or any of the contemplative activities. Like, that's kind of what got dropped out of the talk because I got rambling on about hockey pool and stuff like that. there's this whole range, spiritual conversation, Lectio Divina, catechism, like the repetition of a numinous phrase, Lord Jesus, have mercy upon me, a sinner. Those practices. And really, people say, how could I ever do that? Well, you can do it just like that. 10 minutes, you're doing it. Or you just read for Lectio. You read the pierced, transfixed. You're going to read anyway. So it's not like big labor. It's just, you just turn up, not even, it's a nano thing, whatever. Just walk through the door. It's right there.
Paul?
Tim, I just wanted to go back to the comment you made about in North America, we're sort of undergoing this deep depression because of this displacement. Do you think it's also, or complementary with that, the fact that there are fewer and fewer places left?
Yeah.
The big box stores, the way you drive down the highway.
Yeah.
And every place is the same place. In other words, there is no place anymore.
But if we had eyes, we would see that wilderness was ubiquitous. I can imagine seeing. I'm looking over there for a dust bunny. You people have very keen eyes. But just looking at it, like Don McKay is very good at this. Like you call the dog and the dog doesn't answer. Wilderness. Or you're working with a tool, the tool breaks. Wilderness. So the ubiquity of wilderness. Like I've made this new friendship at the University of Victoria with a microbiologist who is studying bacteria. It eats methane. Man, that's everywhere. Not the methane eating stuff. Otherwise, we'd have climate change beach. But bacteria. Like how can you get out of it? And I think part of our despair, and despair is a sin. I think Origins says it's one of the sins. One of the eight sins. Who's thinking of seven? It's gotten worse. It's eight. And sin always tells falsehood. And the falsehood that despair says is that there's no way out of this. There's no way out of this. And if you were an adult, enlightened individual, you would realize that there's no way out. And so cynicism and so on and so forth becomes a mark of acuity, an adulthood. It's lying. That's not true. That's a lie. That's the mouth of sin. If I can speak theologically,
But it's not just the. Sorry, I didn't even put my hand up. It's not just the box stores. Like it's in the folio. Paper. There's this person doing research. This is wonderful research, right? But we could put I think it's like 1,000 gigabytes on 1 centimeter chip, where now we could do 25 gigabytes on 100 centimeters. And they're saying that's going to be, the word used is, it's going to transform the culture. It's going to transform.
Well, this is
That's how do you. This is how do you orient to spirit.
Well, this part of our corruption. We believe that knowledge now is the possession of certain bits of information.
Yeah.
And the universities are completely into this corruption. They speak of students. I don't think here, but they speak of students as clients. Consumers. You made me angry. You made me read Heidegger. I am unhappy with the product that you have sold me, and you shouldn't make me read Heidegger. So yeah, but things were bad before. Things were bad before when Benedict set up his first monastery in Subiaco. He was living in a cave. People were killing one another in Rome, and it didn't get rosier for Benedict in that cave. One of the first people who came to live with him didn't like him and tried to kill him. You know, so I think this is just me, a kind of parting word. My hunch is, and because I'm an artist, because I'm a writer, I go on these hunches. My hunch is that we are either on the edge of or just beginning another great contemplative age. And for us in North America, it's going to be very different because, again, to speak personally, I don't think there is a way to resuscitate the old religious orders. I speak from the Catholic tradition. I think it's gone. They're not going to start filling up Cistercian monasteries like that. So the contemplation is going to be like Benedict's contemplation. Benedict was a layman. And it's going to be in the world. And, And you think, how can we start it? Where are we going to get the money to do that? It's not going to cost anything. And it's not going to even involve a lot of work. It's just a matter of turning. And valuing the epistemological standing of that gate for its political import, for its sort of beauty, so, and for what it, yeah, how it individuates. Good.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah, lovely.
I mentioned to you that tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at Greenwood's Bookshop in Edmonton, Tim will be speaking and reading some of his recent work under the title The Canadian Poetry.
The Projects of Canadian Poetry.
The Projects of Canadian Poetry.